I was working out a lot. I was reading a bunch. I was writing. I was doing all the things you think you are going to do when you stop working. And at some point, you know, meaning would find me. And then, you know, one morning after dropping my kids off at school, I sat down and I turned on my computer and there were no messages there. And there was like, oh, wait, I realized that I had basically isolated myself and that I was no longer a part of anything, really. I was no longer a part of a bigger organization. I wasn't working toward anything. And you go, huh, here I am with everything I've ever dreamed of. And I'm not really feeling so great about myself. Why is that?
You're listening to Searching for America. Great to have you along. I'm Robin Curnow with my outsider perspective on what's happening here in the USA. My guest this week is Paul Olinger. He was one of Facebook's first 250 employees. He retired at 42, only to find himself, he says, bored, lonely, and driving his wife crazy. So instead of going back to Facebook or going back to tech, he took to the stage. He's now a stand-up comedian and he's host of the Reasonably Happy podcast. I caught up with Paul after I'd watched him at the Laughing Skull Comedy Club here in Atlanta. And we talked about what's funny and what's not so funny in today's political environment. What have you seen change in terms of the way other comedians that you hang out with have changed their skits or said more in the last few months since Trump came in? Has it changed?
I don't know that it has. You know, I mean, we've seen this movie before and, you know, going back 8 years. And I remember making a choice to not discuss him on stage, not because of whether I was pro or con of him. But because when you say the word, people stop listening, whether they're for him or against him, they jump to whatever their opinion is. And they're either putting up barriers because they don't want to hear it and the name offends them, or they anticipate you criticizing something they feel very positively about. And I'm not a good enough comedian. Well, I'm not committed enough to the political dialogue to try to fight through that. I know comics who do a very good job of it, but I find audiences get very tired when they are hearing about things like that over and over and over again, either from people that are very anti or very pro, although the anti voices far exceed the favorable voices for Trump in the comedy community.
Yeah, and I think that's because the comedy community is probably just naturally sort of more progressive and liberal.
And younger also. Yes.
Yeah, that's true. What I did find interesting about, so you did like, what was it, 10 comedians within 10 minutes.
10 excruciating minutes for you. Yes, it was 10 minutes.
But, so no politics at all. The other nine comedians and you, nobody touched politics, okay? Mm. But then there were some of these touchstone cultural issues that were kind of skirted over. What I did notice was that it was actually considered still fair game to just go after white men. Like, this is the funniest. It's an audience of primarily middle-class white people. Mm. And everybody was just going for the white dudes.
This is a thing.
How do you feel about this? I mean, are you having to step in? I mean, this is,
you know,
it got a bit tiring. I'll be honest with you.
Well, I think that's a good word for it. It's not terribly creative. There is a comedian person in the comedy community who posted something on Facebook the other day that said, if you're not a part of a group, don't talk about that group. If you're not trans, don't talk about trans people. If you're not black, don't talk about black people. What he didn't say was, if you're not white, don't talk about white people. If you're not male, don't talk about guys. So I posted on there, oh, this is good. I'll never have to hear another mansplaining joke again in my life. But, you know, it's... they would call it punching up. I think it's lazy. I think it's very, very lazy. And you did hear a lot of it the other night.
It's a tricky conversation because it is all these, like I said, touched on cultural issues and the nerve around it is quite raw. But if a white guy had been saying the same sort of stuff, making jokes about black men, for example, or trans or trans folks, or even just women, in the same kind of tone, just over and over again. I mean, you'd be called out for being racist or homophobic or, you know, transphobic or misogynist.
Probably.
So how difficult it is to navigate all of that?
Well, I think if you want to talk about those things, you have to really commit to talking about them and making the jokes better than the jokes you heard the other night about Karens and white men and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, there are plenty of comedians who, white guy comedians who talk about women or black guys or whatever, but they're committed to that bit and they make it nuanced and intelligent and insightful. Not all of them. Some of them are, you know, they just harp on stereotype. And you know, since Trump has been reelected, maybe there is, or going back 2 or 3 years leading to this reelection, there's been a big pushback against woke, and you'll hear people saying things now on stage because they can get away with it where 3 or 4 years ago they couldn't.
They would have been excommunicated and canceled.
What's that?
They would have been excommunicated.
Correct.
If you'd made a joke about...
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the mob had a lot of power 3 years ago that it no longer has. And so, and people are taking advantage of that, basking in the sun of a post-winter spring, or so they see it. But they will no doubt overcorrect. And there's every likelihood that they'll be just as lazy as what we were talking about before. But for me, it's like, if you really have to go down that road and say, I'm going down this road, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make it really, really good. For me personally, I'm not interested in that road. Let other people try to go there. I'm more interested in exploring things like, you know, the inconsistencies where people say one thing or do another. The things about me that stories from my marriage that demonstrate what a nightmare I am to live with, or what contradictions I have in myself, and why my sort of, I would say the biggest theme for me is my futile attempt to bring order to a chaotic world. And it manifests in all kinds of crazy ways in my anxiety and stuff like that. I find it easier to be the punchline myself, as opposed to trying to offer nuanced social, commentary and try to make it funny in a world where people are just dying to judge you. So yeah. I tend to avoid it, though. I'll once in a while sort of say things like, you know, I have a joke where I mention the Terminator, and of course, you know, half the audience was too young to ever have seen it, but they've seen the reboot where the Terminator was made of all recycled materials and played by a half Latino trans actor, such that, you know, they were represented properly, and you can't say hasta la vista baby as a white American English speaking actor. So it's things like that, you know, they're sort of asides more than they are the crux of the material.
Yeah. And I think there's been such a backlash against woke on various levels and across all communities. And you can call woke whatever you want to call it. I mean, some people are just appalled by the smallest wokeness,
sure,
and others are just sort of outraged by everything. But still, I think that sense of correction is here, but do you feel the audiences are ready for it? The one thing about being a comedian must be trying to gauge how far you can push your audience or not.
I think that people are open to it. Others aren't. You know, it's a shift of power. That's really what we're talking about here. And that what's somewhat hypocritical about this woke movement, the oppressed versus the oppressor, is as soon as the oppressed gain power, what do they start to do? They start to exercise it. You've seen it in every revolution in modern history, right? So as soon as the, you know, quote, woke oppressed become college administrators, they start mandating that their orthodoxy be taught and not be questioned by students and faculty alike, lest ye be cast out. And there's innumerable examples of that in academia all around the world. I do think, and I have many I have many problems with DEI, but with so many things, you're already seeing other, you're already seeing Trump and his people overplay their hand. Mm-hmm. And when a plane crashes and the first thing he says is DEI caused this plane to crash, well, that just, you know, diminishes his credibility in what should be a very thoughtful debate and why DEI, what is truly flawed about DEI that is really causing problems in the corporate world and on college campuses all over the country and around the, in several countries around the world. Like, let's have a substantive conversation about what's truly wrong, as opposed to blaming the weather on DEI and blaming gravity on some homosexual conspiracy. Like, let's talk about the real issues for what they are and try to get to a meaningful solution and compromise.
You were one of the early employees at Facebook, and Facebook has come out. I mean, we're on the subject of woke and DEI, which is diversity, equality, and inclusion
equity.
The difference
between equity and equality is an important part of that conversation.
That's a very good point. Sorry.
Sorry, I was just mansplaining there.
Yes, you
please
were.
Forgive me.
Thank you, Mr. White, middle-aged man, telling me what to do.
I'm
we're
so
gonna have to
sorry.
Cancel
I'm
you immediately.
Do, hashtag do better. That's what I need to do.
And I'm going to go hashtag me too.
There you go.
But I mean, look at what happened at Facebook. For someone who was there at the, you know, in the incubation days with Zuckerberg, and obviously I think with Sheryl Sandberg, you told me the other night. And then, you know, they're at a point where they're leaving female sanitary products in the men's bathrooms for all those men who menstruate. You know, how far, how ludicrous does it have to get?
It's about the orthodoxy. I left before any of that. I left in 2011, and it was a very different world, and presumably a very different company. Well, it was a very different company. I mean, it was a fraction of the size. It wasn't the focus of everything in the news cycle as it is today. And you know, Zuck was a very well-known personality, but he wasn't a multi-centa-billionaire at the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's grown up and he's changed, and he has the permission to kind of do some things he probably never, undo some things he probably never agreed with in the first place. And I think, you know, the removal of men's or of women's sanitary products from the men's restroom is a good place to start. My only issue is if he's going to do that, I think he personally should go into all the restrooms and remove the tampons and maxi pads himself. You know, like he should knock on the doors and say, I'm sorry, Bruce, please hand over the Tampax.
Just
that would be
from
some great content. Wouldn't you love to see the reel of Zuck doing that? That would be hilarious.
Yeah. What is Zuck like?
I've met him on a few occasions, but I don't know him personally. And he may know who I am, but I don't know him personally. But you know, I do remember him the Friday all hands meetings when I was an employee, when it was still a relatively small company, and he'd get up there and he'd talk about the future of the company. And I remember being in awe of the vision that he had and almost doubt. He was so ambitious that I was somewhat doubtful about it. You know, he would be talking about connecting humankind. And as a salesperson, I'm sitting there going, well, how do I beat Yahoo or how do I beat MySpace? And it's like, no. They're not even playing the same game. I think Zuck is, you know, he had vision and follow through in a way that seemed unreasonable to everybody at the time, but in retrospect is, you know, he was obviously right. And I think he's, you know, Jobsian or Gatesian in that manner. And to do that, to be that kind of person, you can't worry about what other people think.
Do you consider yourself one of those original tech bros? I mean, do you come from that starter mode mentality?
I don't think so. I think I'm too old to be a tech bro. I don't think they'd have me. Maybe not smart enough to be a tech bro. I worked at a digital media music company, called Launch.com from 1997, right when I got out of business school, coincidentally founded by Sheryl Sandberg's late husband, Dave Goldberg, who was a wonderful person. And I consider Sheryl a friend, and I think she's a outstanding human being as well. So I worked for Launch for 4 years, and then Yahoo bought us. They basically saved us from the dot-com bubble, and I worked at Yahoo for 4 years. And so I had a wonderful experience working for some of the early companies in the internet, but I don't see, you know, and I was 38 when I started at Facebook, so I was on the old side. So I don't really identify with the millennial generation of tech bros. I guess I'm not sure Elon's a millennial, but I don't really see myself through that lens. I'm definitely more oriented toward Gen X.
When you look at the Elons and the Zucks and the guys who are working within this administration, do you think that they're tempering down some of MAGA's worst instincts? Do you think having them there, these libertarian, sort of non-religious, almost visionary geeks? I'm trying, you know, Elon just seems to be so on the spectrum at times that you kind of wonder how it's working and how it's going to work out. what's your reading of how that cohort of men is playing out within Washington right now?
I'd like to think that Mark Andreessen has more influence than Elon Musk does, or has the ear of some people over there. I find Mark to be a very intelligent and thoughtful person.
Alex Cobb? What about him?
Don't know. I don't know about Alex, and I haven't really listened to Alex. I've read a lot of Andreessen's writing, and I've listened to him for hours in interviews. And I think he's an incredibly smart, thoughtful guy from the Midwest who wants to inspire innovation and believes that government needs to be more efficient. And he's not the same kind of reactionary. You know, Elon is supposed to be autistic, and all respect to people with that condition, but he lacks a human touch that I think would be very, very helpful when you're talking about creating efficiency. And I wouldn't start with eliminating everybody's jobs and then moving backwards. I think I'd start with a sound argument about which departments should be invested in and which should be divested, and begin that conversation there. And I think Andreessen would. I think Elon is kind of, it's all a show, you know, and he's out there tweeting crazy stuff because that's what gets attention. And he is of a spirit with Trump along those lines. The question is going to be, how long will Trump keep him around? I just finished listening to H.R. McMaster's memoir about his time in the White House. And it's clear Trump doesn't keep people around for very long now, or he didn't in the first administration. We'll see what's going to happen here. But even longtime allies like Steve Bannon didn't stick around for long. And maybe Bannon ends up gaining some power back from Elon and you know, Doge sort of withers away. Who knows?
Yeah, it's those two sort of push and pull between the Bannons and the Musks, I think is the broader sort of macro trend that's going to be interesting in the second term. Which devil or angel on the shoulder is going to win out when it comes to this?
Or which devil or devil, I mean, depending upon your point of view. And for the record, I didn't vote for Trump, but I didn't vote for Kamala either. I mean, I think our system is pushing things so far to the fringe that we're lacking in decent candidates that any of us could be proud of. You know, and I think, as we mentioned briefly when we were together briefly on Friday night, you know, I find this assertion that America was too racist and misogynist to elect a black woman to be president to be insulting. The candidate in particular was not one who, you know, was hugely confidence building. Just around the time of the election, Condoleezza Rice wrote an essay in Foreign Affairs about isolationism and the dangers of nationalism and things like that. And I heard her interviewed, and I'm like, where's this black woman? Where's this brilliant, insightful, historically informed, and if not visionary, then certainly a woman who understands the way global entities interact. Where's that, as opposed to somebody who sounds like she's been smoking pot all morning? And when she's asked by the very friendliest of interviewers, what's one thing you would change? Can't think of anything? Really? I don't trust. I'm sorry. You didn't win this nomination through primary. You were selected to be vice president because you're a black woman. And, you know, the party just pushed you forward and challenged people to not vote for you because not doing so would prove their racism and misogyny. I'm sorry, but most of America is sick of that bullshit.
Do you have one funny Trump joke?
I really don't. I mean, like, you know, I imagine if we had a conversation and we were discussing him, I just find the guy to be, you know, he's unique in our history, or at least in our modern history. And I think, you know, in line with the whole being unreasonable thing that we were talking about with Zuckerberg, I think he's an unreasonable human being, and unreasonable people get unreasonable things done, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. And with Trump, it's a mixed bag. I think he's pushing back against a lot of the overreach from the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. Getting biological men out of women's sports to me is a very sensible thing to do. And of course the Democrats are like, well, you know, it's such a small number of people. Okay, fine. Then let it go. If it affects so few people, let it go, because it demonstrates to you that your orthodoxy is more important than the implications it has on people's lives. So let it go. I would like nothing more than a strong Democratic candidate to be surfaced at all levels in the midterms and in the next presidential election. It would help all of us.
I agree with you. And the fact that it feels like there's this almost implosion from the sort of center left, which seems to have been cannibalized by the sort of extremist progressives, and this orthodoxy, as you say, doesn't do anybody who is intellectually curious and just wants to get on with their life, which is most Americans in the center, doesn't do anybody any favors. So you made a lot of money when you left Facebook. Or you retired. Were you happy?
Well, I didn't retire. I stopped working.
On your website, it says retire, and I thought that was an interesting choice of words.
I'm okay. Whoever wrote that on my website is fired. I probably wrote that. The nuance of it is, I stopped working at 42. And there's an old joke in Silicon Valley. You know what the hardest part about doing nothing is? Knowing when to quit. And so when I stopped working, I was like, oh, I'm just going to figure out what to do next. And I'd moved home to Atlanta, where I grew up, from Los Angeles, where I'd been working for Facebook. And I was just sort of like spending time with my very young kids. I was working out a lot. I was reading a bunch. I was writing. I was doing all the things you think you are going to do when you stop working. And at some point, you know, meaning would find me. And then, you know, one morning after dropping my kids off at school, I sat down and I turned on my computer, and there were no messages there. And there was like, oh, wait, I realized that I had basically isolated myself, and that I was no longer a part of anything, really. I was no longer a part of a bigger organization. I wasn't working toward anything. And you go, huh, here I am with everything I've ever dreamed of, and I'm not really feeling so great about myself. Why is that? And, you know, eventually I remember looking at Maslow's hierarchy in some article I'm reading about happiness. And you see, the bottom two layers are physiological needs and safety needs. Well, money and work, a paycheck takes care of that real nice. And then the next level is belongingness. And the one above that is self-esteem. Well, you don't get a lot of that when you're sitting at home by yourself, regardless of how big your house is or how fancy your car is. That we're designed as social creatures, or we've evolved into social tribal creatures, and we want to be a part of something, and we need to be useful to earn self-esteem. We have to contribute. We have to help other people if we want to feel good about ourselves. And of course, the top layer is self-actualization. Well, you're not going to actualize yourself, you know, watching Netflix at home by yourself. Or working on your, you know, your putting at the country club. And so there's all these things we think about or presumptions that more will make us happy, more status, more money, more power, more luxury, more vacations, all these kinds of things. But what really makes us happy is connection with other people and having a sense of purpose. It's pretty simple. And when I started writing and started saying, like, I think I have something to say here, when I started doing the podcast and working towards something, I started to feel, I wouldn't say a sense of accomplishment, but I'm like, hey, I'm doing something. I'm working on something. And when you stop working, when you sort of try to change lanes, I'm going to go from corporate person to comedian. I'm going to go from corporate person to podcaster. You know, I was a little sensitive about, oh, well, what are people going to think? Well, who cares what people think? And you know what they think after you do it for a little while? Oh, I guess he's committed to that. That's cool. And, you know, and then you start meeting other people, you start meeting fellow travelers who share the same values as you. You start meeting other people who are podcasters. You interview incredible people. You call people and go, "Hey, I have this podcast. Will you talk to me?" "Yeah, I will." "Oh, really? Why? I'm nobody." But then they just do, because you're stating, "These are the things I care about, and I'm interested in exploring them with you. Would you be game for that?" You know, you've got lots of journalistic credibility, and you know, you've interviewed some of the most famous people in the world. But when most podcasters start, they're just like, "Hey, I have this idea. You know, would you be down for it?" And it's incredible who says yes when you ask the right way. I interviewed Gretchen Rubin last week, who's sold millions and millions of books. The first book she did in the happiness world is called The Happiness Project, which I have right here. From Gretchen Rubin. And she's gone on to sell millions of copies. She has a weekly newsletter with 1 million+ subscribers. She's a big deal, and she thinks about this stuff sincerely, you know. And one of the quotes I pulled from this book is that growth equals happiness, or happiness equals growth, right? And you go, "Oh, yeah, that makes sense to me." Because if you're not growing, then you're dying, you know. And even though growth is painful, you have the satisfaction of working towards something. There's a reason to get up tomorrow. I had lunch yesterday, or coffee yesterday, with a guy named Marty Hackle, who's known as, I think, Dr. Fashion and for Golf Digest. He's the fashion guy who writes for Golf Digest.
Okay, that's the most random job, but how fabulous.
Well, he's 82 years old. And I was like, "No way." He's like a suave, very fashionable guy, plays golf, and he's very active. And I was like, we're talking about stuff that he was doing in the 70s. And I'm like, "Marty, how old are you?" Oh, yeah. He's like, "I'm 82. And I was like, "Damn." And he's like, "Look, if you stay active, if you keep moving forward, you'll stay healthy on average, right? I mean, cancer is a random thing to some degree. But like, he's been very fortunate with his health, but it's also based on his attitude and based on his activity. And so if you keep moving, if you keep growing, you will stay healthier and happier. Work provides that. It's work is like a distract. Work kind of pulls us forward. And when you choose to stop working and start working on your terms, it's like you've got to be self-propelled as opposed to waking, which is good, because like, you don't feel resentful of the forces of nature, the corporate forces that are forcing you to go to CES in Las Vegas 3 days after Christmas or New Year's or whatever. You know, like, you don't feel like some third party is keeping you from spending time with your kids. Mm. You're choosing to work in a way that that satisfies your soul, and that is based on intrinsic rewards instead of extrinsic rewards. Believe me, I'd love some extrinsic rewards to this career I'm on, but it's but it's not what keeps me going every day. And I hope that my kids, if they view me fairly, you know, at some point in the future, they say, "My dad did stuff because he thought it was cool and worth doing, and in retrospect, most of it was."
I enjoyed every moment I was at CNN, and I could have stayed. I just wanted more. And I realized the more that I wanted was to control my own time. And somebody said to me once, you know, I was CNN's Africa correspondent when I was pregnant and feeding two small children.
Oh, my goodness.
I had my babies while I was CNN's Africa correspondent.
Wow.
And I managed it. And I managed it because we were out there in Johannesburg in Africa. And in many ways, being a foreign correspondent in those days, I was able, and I was married to the bureau chief. So we had our little mini bureau, and the babies would either come with me or I'd go and do something. And you know what I mean? We were able to schedule our days. So when there was news, I was full on. When there was no news, I was at home. Mm-hmm. When you lose that ability, and particularly when I came to Atlanta and became an anchor, where you have to be at work behind the desk at a specific time every day, over and over again, the one thing I missed was my ability to control the time in my day. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes earlier, 10 minutes late. Oh no, I've got to take the kids to the doctor. It was those small things. And I think that's the difference between being a successful working mother or working parent. And
but
being
mostly
an
mothers
one.
Still, I mean, it's absolutely, it falls heavier on women. Absolutely.
Yeah. But for me, it was about time. I was like, you know what? I just need to be able to choose my own time.
For me, it was about wanting to discover more of who I am. It was about self-expression. And the corporate world, I think it got much, much worse after I left. But the ability, the necessity to have to watch everything that you say, to be on message, to, you know, never veer from the company line, that was not something I was good at. And it would have become more of a problem the longer I stayed.
Are you dyslexic?
I am not.
Is it your wife then?
She's the bad one. That's
right.
I'm just kidding.
It's her fault. My
wife, we believe my wife is dyslexic, although she was never diagnosed or treated. My dogs are not dyslexic.
Are they dyslexic too, maybe?
We have two high-strung French bulldogs, and the doorbell just rang, and they lose their mind. Apologies.
No apologies necessary, because that happened to me the other day. And I had, I don't know if you heard earlier, the leaf blowers outside the window a little bit earlier.
Suburbia, USA.
The reason I obviously, because as a matter of disclosure, both Paul and I sit on the board of trustees at the Skank School here in Atlanta, which is this sort of extraordinary school for dyslexic kids. It's been around for what, decades and decades. And when our youngest daughter was diagnosed with dyslexia, we went to the educational psychologist, and she explained to us that it was genetic, and either parent would, one of you, she said, is dyslexic. And my husband just pointed at me and went, "Her." I was like, "Okay, it's me." Yeah, but yeah.
Did you have struggles in school growing up?
I failed second grade. I mean, I repeated. I mean, I had went to four schools by the time I was 10.
Wow.
In
Joburg?
This was in Johannesburg. Yes. So yeah. No, I mean, I had and I've written about it a lot. Was how I do think that being dyslexic kind of makes you a bit of a street fighter, particularly if you're undiagnosed. You learn to survive, or you learn to sort of thrive in ways that maybe allows you to push ahead, because you kind of go from A to B via Z.
Mm.
And you see, I sound American. I said Z, not Z there.
Way to go.
But yes, I mean, it's a difficult thing having a dyslexic kid, particularly in this day and age, if they aren't remediated at a school like the Skank School.
You know, before I had kids, I was always like, well, I want my kids to go to Harvard and Princeton and Yale and all that. And then you have kids and you realize that every kid is different, and every kid has strengths and unique needs. And it turns out that my older child, my son, reads like crazy, and my daughter would rather do just about anything except read a book. She's already blown through her Audible annual subscription. However, she loves stories and she loves listening to books, but she is, she's not a reader. That's not her strength. Thank goodness for the Skank School.
Your dog, this website of yours that might or might not be correct, it says that of your dogs, one of them's called Theo, but the other one is Colonel Tom Parker.
That's correct. That is true. I'm just kidding about the earlier thing.
Name
Colonel Tom Parker, you know, and many probably know, was Elvis's manager, and he was a domineering manager who stole from Elvis. He was a bad guy. He wasn't a good guy, but he was, you know, part of the thing that made Elvis Elvis. And you know, I went to college in Memphis. I grew up in Atlanta. Went to college in Memphis, Tennessee, at Rhodes College. Probably been to Graceland 20 times. My son's name is Elvis.
I did not know that. Now that is not on your website.
No. Well, I probably shouldn't talk about it. But anyway, and so I don't know, man. The culture of the Delta, the Mississippi Delta, and the blues and the legend of Elvis. I just remember going to Graceland the first time and being so impressed that Elvis was really just a simple country boy who happened to be able to sing black, as Sam Phillips would have said. And he, you know, he loved his mama, and he loved and he took care of his relatives, and he was a simple guy who got taken advantage of. I remember they say, you know, like Elvis gave all this money to charity and he never took a tax deduction because he didn't feel like that was in the spirit of his giving. And there's a certain amount of naivete there, but there's also a certain beauty and kindness to it that, you know, demonstrates the character he had, even though he, you know, ended up having his many struggles in life.
It's so funny. I actually did not realize we had this commonality because before we started chatting, I said to you, when we moved to America, the first place we went to, I took the kids to, was Graceland. We didn't go to New York. We didn't go to Disney.
That's great. That's fantastic.
We went to Graceland because it was also, I mean, I think there was a sort of a double whammy for me on that one was that I remember listening to the Paul Simon Graceland album, which was this blend of
the best records of the last 50 years.
Exactly. And there's this sort of combination of these Zulu beats of Ladies with Black Mbazo and this sort of very deep sense of the African in me, and then this sort of meandering car drive along the Mississippi Delta. I mean, I was drawn there. I had to go.
Yeah.
And then you're right. You go to Graceland, and it's actually an incredibly classy place. You know, you'd expect
well,
to be
it
some
wasn't
filthy
in 19,
jungle. I know.
In 1987, it wasn't terribly classy.
Okay. Well, now when we went, I was like, this place is actually looks like some of the parents' homes that I've seen, you know, and school,
if my wife would let me decorate our living room in the motif of the jungle room, it would have cloth on the ceiling. But you know, in 1987, before Elvis Presley Enterprises came in and consolidated everything, Graceland was across the street from Graceland was just sort of this like strip center. It was like a strip mall, and it was all independent owned shops that were not paying licensing fees to the estate of Elvis Presley. And then EPE came in there and, you know, basically shut down all those vendors. They got the licensing streamlined. So, you know, they were getting royalties on everything that had Elvis's name or had the TCB lightning bolt on it and really turned it into a major, major entity. So it was a very different thing, but they've really created, created a really strong and consistent brand around Elvis in the last 35 years.
Yeah. And after watching the movie, I mean, that's why I'm like, Colonel Tom Parker is not my favorite person. I'm almost devastated by Elvis sometimes after I've watched the Elvis movie.
We call him Colonel, and sometimes he's not the greatest dog in the world, but don't tell my wife I said that. Hey, if you loved Graceland by Paul Simon, you should listen to Lucinda Williams' Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, which is another record that is infused with the humidity and Spanish moss of the South from the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
You can feel the steam coming through the speakers of your hi-fi.
I gave you this as a heads up, like with all my guests.
Yes, you
because
did.
Because I think this is a hard one to answer just off the cuff, spitballing. If you can time travel anywhere in American history, where and when would you go?
Okay. So since your last guest chose to, I took that as permission to choose to as well. And I wanted to say something, you know, like, I don't know. I thought about, you know, the Wild West, and I thought some shoot 'em out Dodge City place. But then you watch like, you know, Deadwood on HBO, the miniseries from 20 years ago. And I'm like, I don't think I want to go there. I don't think that's a really great place to be. So I picked two. Okay.
Well, Al Swearingen might get you. So
Al Swearingen, outstanding way to reach back and grab that one.
Yeah.
I want to go to Houston in July of 1969, and I want to be in NASA Mission Control during the Apollo moon landing and the launch and all and the return and all that stuff. I don't think there could be a more exciting part of modern American history to witness than that.
I think that is a winner.
It was the culmination of a decade of work that was seen as absurd assuming it actually happened, by the way. There's a lot of people online that want to tell you that it was all filmed in a studio in Burbank.
One of my next guests coming up is actually someone who's an expert on conspiracy theories.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
So we've got a whole 45 minutes
fantastic.
On that one.
Yeah, bring your tin hat. Yeah. So I would love to see all those the flat top haircut dudes in short shirts and ties running around the Mission Control Center and feel the energy of what it was like, because it must have been palpable, just the wonder and the optimism that was in the air. And you know, that one was a triumph. There are plenty of places where we've fallen down technologically and politically as a country, of course. But in that moment, it must have been a triumph. And I have another one, if you don't have any follow-up questions about that.
No, you go for it.
Okay. Now, this is along the lines of pop culture, but it also goes back. I want to go back to September 9th, 1978, at Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles, because that was the night that the Blues Brothers Band opened for Steve Martin, and they recorded their album Briefcase Full of Blues. So if you remember, the Blues Brothers started as Danny Aykroyd and John Belushi with Paul Schaefer and the band they pulled together as basically like a Saturday Night Live sketch. Like, it was sort of a, hey, we're going to do these characters. And they went on Saturday Night Live, and then they kind of did it again. And it was turning into this big thing, like sometimes characters on SNL become. And then they decided, hey, let's do this for real. And they pulled together, you know, the greatest blues band they could, as Paul Schaefer told me all about on my podcast, Reasonably Happy, last month.
Where you can get your podcasts.
That's right.
Apple, Spotify.
But then to see these guys, to be in the crowd at Universal Amphitheater in 1978, pre-internet, just early cable TV, to go there and see this band that was electric open up for Steve Martin in a white suit and a black tie would have been one of the coolest cultural moments that I could think of in my youth. And yes, I'd love to see Motley Crue in 86 or Led Zeppelin in 75 or The Who in 77. But
I think Elvis would have been amazing.
You know, I was going to say Elvis in Vegas at the Vegas Hilton, but what I've heard about those shows is that he was way past his prime by the time, you know, he went to the Hilton shows and, you know, Elvis in Hawaii and all that stuff. So I would have wanted to see him
early
when he
Elvis.
Was Baby Elvis, maybe the 69 comeback tour.
You just did a good Elvis voice. And on that note, can you say goodbye in your Elvis voice?
Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you. We could talk for hours, I think. But yeah, America, I'm still looking for it. Have you found it?
Have I?
Yeah.
I'm a part of it.
I know. It's a great country.
I'm happy to be a part of it, and I wish more people who are a part of it appreciated the good parts of it, as opposed to just focusing on all the things that are not perfect about it.
I agree with you.
Thank you for having me on. It's lovely to know you now.
It's my absolute pleasure. Yeah, you too. You too. We'll see you at the next board meeting.
Look forward to it.
Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Robin Kurnow. This has been Searching for America with my outsider perspective on what's happening in the USA. Go to my website at searchingforamericapod.com and please do sign up for the weekly newsletter. It's a little bit of extra background information and my perspective on what's happening here in the States, and also as to why I chose today's guest. So thanks for joining me as always. Appreciate it. See you again next week.